Okay, now my focus this morning is on leadership, and in particularly the idea of authentic leadership. And part of this morning's event is the sort of formal launch of the my book, The Authentic Leader, that was published just a couple of weeks ago. So I want to start off by saying, why have I written a book on authentic leadership? Because a few people have asked me this. You know, they associate me with certain topics and haven't necessarily associated me and my work with leadership. And basically, there are three reasons why I've developed a book on leadership. The first is that as I go about my business from area to area, working with different groups of people, either on training courses or consultancy projects or conferences or being a guest speaker at a university, all those sort of things, as I go around doing my work, what I find is that there are all sorts of problems in the modern workplace. And I think a lot of those problems are linked to leadership, in the sense that many of the solutions to those problems lie with better leadership. So that's one reason. I think leadership is a major issue these days. Secondly, in terms of the idea of authentic leadership, there's an awful lot of stuff that's been written in recent years about authentic leadership, and I disagree with most of it. So I felt the need to put in my 10 penneth, as it were, as my dear old mother used to say, to put in my 10 penneth to say, no, that's not what authentic leadership is all about, you've misunderstood it, and to present a more realistic version of authentic leadership. And I'll come back to that later in my talk about what do I mean by authentic leadership. But the third reason, in some ways the most important reason for writing a book about leadership, is that, as far as I'm concerned, all professionals are leaders. All professionals have a degree of leadership responsibility. It's a bit of a stereotype to think that if we're talking about leadership, we're talking about managers. But as will become clearer as I develop my ideas this morning around leadership for you, that I think what it's about is recognizing that if you are a professional, then you shared some degree of leadership responsibility. Because if you think about it, the idea that there are managers who are paid to lead, and then there are staff who are paid to follow, is a bureaucratic model, not a professional model. The idea of a professional model in terms of leadership is that we work together to support one another to produce the best results we can for the vulnerable people that we are trying to support and empower, and so on. So this sort of us-them mentality of there are the managers who are paid to lead and staff who are paid to follow is something that I don't think is very helpful. And to my mind, part of professionalism is the idea that we recognize an element of leadership within our professional responsibilities, if you like. So, three, to my mind, important reasons why I felt the need to write a book about leadership and authentic leadership in particular. So, what I want to focus on now, though, is why should we focus on leadership at all? Not just specifically around the book, but why focus on leadership at all? And the first and perhaps most important part of my answer to that is this key word of neoliberalism. Now, unfortunately, this term neoliberalism has come to be oversimplified to be just like a general term of abuse. You know, to describe somebody's ideas as neoliberal is without any sort of analysis of what that means. In some circles, in some quarters, shall we say, it's become quite common. It's just a way of, in a sense, implying that somebody is right-wing in their thinking. And if they're neoliberal, then the chances are they are right-wing in their thinking. But there's more to the term than just a general meaning of being right of centre, shall we say, in terms of thinking. What neoliberalism is fundamentally about is the idea that the market forces should be allowed to shape not just the economy, but to shape society as well. So a major focus on this very tenuous assumption, in my view, that if you allow market forces to run freely, then that will shape not just the economy, but society in a generally positive way. That's the idea in principle. Of course, in reality, it's very different. But what we have to recognize to begin with is that's the principle behind it, is free market forces are allowed to just move forward and everything will work out in the end. And of course, we have to question that. Now, one of the problems with neoliberalism, that's a carrot and a stick, by the way, in case you can't make it out. One of the problems with neoliberalism is what's come to be known as managerialism. And what managerialism refers to is the idea of applying a business model to public services. So this goes back to the days of Margaret Thatcher, when what she did was two things, basically. One was that she privatized as much of public service as she could get away with, and what was left, she tried to make as businesslike as possible. Because she had this idea, which again is a very dodgy idea once you start to analyze it, she had this idea that in the business world, there is this thing called the profit motive. And so people will be motivated to be efficient and to work hard and not be wasteful and to be successful, because the harder they work, the more efficient they are, the more profit is made and the more everybody benefits. Whereas in public service, according to Margaret Thatcher, there was no profit motive, so there was no motivation, which was why, in her view, public services were wasteful, inefficient, and in need of significant reform. Now, there are two significant problems there, at least two significant problems in terms of that analysis. One is the idea that somehow the profit motive makes private enterprise efficient and effective is a bit suspect. I suspect any of you who have ever worked in the private sector will know that it doesn't matter how much profit they're making, that doesn't make them necessarily efficient and effective. It's an ideological myth, that idea. That suits certain people's interests. But then the idea that because there's no profit motive in public service, therefore people are not motivated and are going to be wasteful and inefficient, doesn't take account of the fact that there are things other than profit that motivate people, like a commitment to public service, for example. The fact that people want to do well, want to be successful, not be wasteful, because they value public service, because they see it as, if you like, a humanitarian commitment. Now, do you see how terms like that were not part of Margaret Thatcher's vocabulary? In a sense. So a key part of what Margaret Thatcher did, and other governments have since continued in one form or another, is this idea of managerialism, that is applying a business model to public services. And that creates all sorts of problems when you do that, because you're basically trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. It's created lots of problems over the years, not least less professional autonomy and more bureaucracy. Because you see, in a business, what counts is the bottom line, which is literally the last line of the profit and loss account. How much profit has been made? And so if there is only room for professionalism in the business world if it actually increases the bottom line. The idea of professionalism as an important thing in its own right is not something that's consistent with a business mentality. It's just about get the job done and make sure that the bottom line is favourable, the profit, in other words. So part of what that does is it takes away a significant degree of professional autonomy and replaces that with a lot of bureaucratic procedures. And what that does then is a number of things. It can demotivate people. It can create unnecessary red tape, shall we say, unnecessary form filling. For example, when I qualified as a social worker, the assessment form we used was basically two sheets of paper. It was about, you know, the basic details of name, address, and all that sort of stuff. A summary of a brief summary of what the issues were, and then there was a page to describe in more detail what the problems or issues were that you're addressing, and then a page or so for your plan about how you're going to address them. And it worked brilliantly just to do that, because it focused people's minds on what are the key issues in this situation. Now, compare that with my experience over the last 18 or so years when I've been doing expert witness work, where what I've been called to do on many an occasion is to read through very thick files that have sometimes got assessments that are 30 or 40 pages. But when I ask the worker, what was the case all about? What were you actually doing? I struggle to get a proper answer. I get vague comments like it was a complex case. Yeah? Now, that getting bogged down in detail, do you see how that may satisfy the bureaucratic requirements? But what about the professional requirements of actually knowing what you're doing? Why are you in this person's life? And it's amazing how often when I've asked that question to people, whether as an expert witness or in other contexts, how people have actually struggled to answer that question. What are you doing in this person's life? And I think a big part of that is managerialism, is this focus on processes, on procedures, of going through a procedure and losing sight of the purpose. Why are you in this person's life? So, some problems brought about by managerialism that have had quite an effect. And we'll come back to some of these in a little while. But while that's been happening in public services, what's been happening in the business world, shall we say, is there's been the impact of globalization. And what that refers to is the idea that now, because of modern technology and various other forms of development, shall we say, what you have now is that the world of business and commerce is very much a global enterprise. And that has significant implications because, for example, there are countries in the world who can offer labour at a much lower cost than happens in the advanced industrialised countries. And so what that produces then is increased competitiveness. There is a focus then on cost reduction. Because why should a company, for example, pay workers in this country to offer a particular service at UK rates when they could have somebody from various other countries offer a similar service online for a fraction of that cost? So can you see how the whole financial world, if you like, has been squeezed by that globalization? Process. So then the net result of this is that in the private sector and in the public sector, there are huge pressures, there are huge difficulties. And one of the results of that is work insecurity across all sectors, basically, private, public, voluntary, whatever. What we've seen is a change in the nature of working life in the last 10, 15, 20 years or so. We've seen a move away from the idea of a job for life into now increasingly short-term contracts, zero-hours contracts and things like that. We've now seen a much greater emphasis on people being self-employed. For example, when I became independent 18 years ago, there were relatively few other people in a social work context who were self-employed. Now, there's quite a significant number of people in a social work context who are self-employed in some way. A lot of people working for agencies, for example. I remember when I first qualified as a social worker, they had these strange things called agencies in London, because it was difficult to recruit staff in London because of the cost of living in London compared with a social work salary. So there were these strange, mysterious things called agencies that had temporary staff to provide for what were then social services departments. But now, of course, I work with some organisations. I do training or consultancy with some organisations where anything up to a third of their staff are temporary staff from an agency. So do you see how that illustrates this general trend of the world of work is far less secure than it used to be? That's very much in the interests of employers, employing organisations, to have that flexibility, but it's not so much in the interests of staff to have that insecurity. As some of you may be aware, it can create significant problems in terms of things like getting a mortgage. Yeah? If you're self-employed, for example, unless you've been self-employed for a long time and you can show evidence that you've got a successful business, then getting a mortgage is extremely difficult. So there are all sorts of problems and tensions that come from this. Not least the two that I've highlighted here. One is problems with stress and staff engagement. So one of the issues here is because of the pressures within the world of work and the insecurities that are there for so many people, then the result can be, in some places at least, a high level of stress. And other issues linked to that as well. For example, I've come across people who are being bullied. They've told me that they're being bullied, and when I've tried to guide them on how they have to raise that as an issue of what they need to do to get support, they've told me that they don't do that because of the insecurity in the employment market, that they're worried about being seen as a troublemaker, and then they will struggle to get work, they'll struggle to earn a living in a sense. So all sorts of problems associated with this. And then there's also the issue about reduction in employment rights as well. That in this country, you may argue that we could do with more employment rights, but compared with lots of other countries, the United States, for example, we have a very sophisticated set of employment rights. But what we've seen in recent years is the erosion of those rights. And in terms of current government policy, plans for eroding those rights even further. And that is part of these changes in the world of work, the broader picture that comes from neoliberalism. The idea that if the market decides that the fewer people are needed for employment, then so be it. That's what will happen. This almost complete faith in the so-called free market. So these are some of the problems then of neoliberalism, and they present major challenges that then are major challenges not just for everybody in general, but specifically for leaders. Because trying to tackle problems around, for example, stress, staff engagement and so on, that is quite a significant challenge. So what are the consequences of this neoliberal way of thinking that, in a sense, has become the norm? Because if you think about it, in terms of the traditional idea of, in politics, of left wing and right wing, what we've seen as a result of this neoliberal way of thinking is the idea of what counts as the centre ground has shifted significantly to the right. Yeah? So what's now seen as sort of moderate centrist thinking 20 years ago would have been seen as quite right wing. So that's part of what neoliberalism has done, is to shift the political focal point, if you like, very much to the right. So that things that were seen as, to some extent, extreme, are now seen as the norm. That's been part of the success, if you like, of neoliberal ideology to shift that very much to the to the right. So what are some of the consequences of this? Well, one consequence is lower morale, high levels of stress, greater sickness absence, problems with recruitment and retention. Any of this seem familiar? Yeah. Now, you can draw a direct line of causality from neoliberal thinking, because these are very clearly the consequences of that thinking. Let's take lower morale and link it to the erosion of professional autonomy. If you have a business model that's based on a bureaucratic emphasis on just focusing on the bottom line, as long as we make a profit, that's the main thing, then what you get in terms of managerialism is a very top-down approach. So you have central government telling local government what to do. And that's been a shift, a political shift linked to neoliberalism. Because if you go back, not that long ago, the traditional idea was that central government focused on national issues and local government was left largely to its own devices to focus on local issues. But what we've seen, again going back to Margaret Thatcher's day, what we've seen is a shift in the balance between central and local government. So now, to a large extent, local government is controlled by central government. So there is less autonomy. So basically, central government tells local government what it needs to do. So you have targets and performance indicators and things like that, which are basically control strategies to say, do what we want you to do, or we will reduce your budget, we will make life difficult for you. So that partnership arrangement, if you like, between local and central government has now largely been replaced by a top-down control relationship. And that's no coincidence that that's happened. That fits perfectly with neoliberalism. Because, you see, what you used to have were the pesky local authorities who would interfere with market forces, who would try and put things like job creation schemes in place and stuff like that, which then goes against the idea that you let the market run its course and everything will be okay in the end. That sort of thinking. Now, coming back to the idea of morale, if central government tells local government what to do, you then have councillors telling senior managers what they need to do. Because councillors can get into very serious trouble if they don't meet the government requirements. So senior managers then tell middle managers what to do, middle managers tell junior managers what to do, and junior managers tell staff what to do, because you have to meet these targets, you've got to get the performance indicators right. So do you see how the whole thing is top down? There is very little room there for professional autonomy. Now, in terms of morale issues, at every step of the way, the message is, you are not important. What's important is that you do what we want you to do. Is that a fair comment? Yeah? So do you see how that undermines morale? It undermines a sense of professionalism, undermines a sense of value of what we do. And then that leaves us prey to, for example, the media, where we become easy pickings for the media that want to improve their sales figures by sensationalizing things, because what we do is not valued as much as it should be. And that, to a certain extent, is a very much a British phenomenon. You know, I've had the opportunity to work with social work education colleagues in half a dozen other countries, and in all of those countries I find that social work is more valued than it is here. I mean, you've only got to go a very short distance to the Republic of Ireland, for example, and you find that social work is valued much more there than it is here. it's quite significant to think that there is this British element to this. But that could be a whole day's discussion in itself. So can you see how there's a tendency then to undermine morale? You combine low morale with high workload pressures, and no wonder we get levels of stress, sickness, absence, and so on, and then problems with recruitment and retention. A lot of people are leaving the profession because why should they stay and put up with this crap? Yeah, I've had that conversation with so many people, basically. A lot of them have had what I call a Tesco's moment. Now, you've all had a Tesco's moment, haven't you? Yeah? You know, I'm going to say it anyway, but I think I don't need to. You know what I mean? That what I mean by a Tesco's moment, when you think, if I worked at Tesco's, could I afford to pay my bills? Would I earn enough without all this? Yeah, that's a Tesco's moment. Do you see how a lot of that comes from, ultimately, the wider political arena of neoliberalism, in a sense? Because one of the things I want to emphasize is that, as far as I'm concerned, the problem is managerialism, not managers. I am regularly in conversation with people, particularly practitioners, who are saying bloody managers this and bloody managers that. Now, I'll be perfectly honest with you. As far as I'm concerned, managers are just like any other group of people. Some are excellent, some are dire, and most are somewhere in between. Yeah? But can't we say that about any group of people? Yeah. So as far as I'm concerned, if you've got a good manager, great. If you've got a poor manager, that's a pity. But the idea that the problem is poor management, do you see how that's distorting the reality? It's much bigger than that. The problem is managerialism, and a lot of managers struggle with managerialism, you know, to try and do a good, effective job in such difficult circumstances. And that's part of the idea that we're all professionals, we all have to share some responsibility for the wider picture, rather than just, you know, get into an us-them sort of mentality. So this is one set of consequences from neoliberalism and managerialism. Another set of consequences is higher levels of tension that can lead to conflict, bullying, and anxiety. Let's just briefly consider each of those in turn for a moment. The higher levels of tension in the workplace, for the reasons I've explained, you know, the lowering of morale, the greater insecurity over the world of work in general, and so on, can lead to all sorts of conflicts, all sorts of difficulties. Now, in certain circumstances, conflict can actually be quite constructive. Conflict can move situations on when they're stuck. For example, conflict can help people appreciate other people's perspective, and they can grow and learn from seeing that. Being prepared to deal with conflict rather than sweep it under the carpet can increase your confidence, it can increase your credibility, it can make you a more skilled practitioner, and so on. So conflict isn't necessarily a bad thing, but what I've seen, and I suspect many of you have seen, is in a lot of situations, the pressures and the tensions and the low morale combine to create a lot of unhealthy conflict in situations. For example, I've worked with students on recall days, as they're called, from placement. You know, I've been brought in as a guest speaker, work with a group of students, and it came out of so many different discussions that I now actually, when I work with a group of students, I ask the question directly to, like, cut to the chase. Have you seen any conflict where you are on placement? And then we have some interesting discussions about, yeah, well, I do, actually. I hadn't thought about it, but this person's in conflict with that person who's in conflict with this group of people, and so on. So can you see how this, again, has its roots in the broader picture? Then there's bullying. It was interesting. I was talking to somebody recently who used to be a police officer, and he retrained as a social worker because he felt that the police world was too macho and uncaring. And he thought that by going into social work, it would suit him better because it's so more caring. And you know what I'm going to say, don't you? What he found was that in some ways it was actually less caring than the police force. Yeah? That although there was a very macho, stoic sort of idea in the police force, you know, the old idea of if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen sort of thing. He said that was very much part of his experience anyway of the police force. I don't want to overgeneralize because obviously I don't know the wider picture, but certainly that had been his experience. But he found that that mentality, if you like, was alive and well when he went into social work as well. Now, do you see how that is something that's changed? During my career, for example, that wasn't the case when I first came into social work. And I think that then creates a sort of a breeding ground for bullying, in a sense. As an expert witness, I've been involved, and as a consultant, I've been involved in a number of situations involving bullying. And I've seen some patterns emerge from that. One of those patterns is that often bullying is one person's way of dealing with their own tensions. They're like taking out their own frustrations on other people. I had one very tragic situation where I was asked to be an expert witness in relation to a case where what had happened was that a team manager had killed himself. He stabbed himself to death. And the reason for that was that he was managing a small team that were under huge pressures. He lost a couple of members from that team as a result of a reorganization, but the workload on the team actually increased following that reorganization. So do you see how it was like burning the candle at both ends? A smaller team, but greater pressures. He became quite stressed, very fraught, very tense. And one day, he lost his temper with a member of staff. He shouted at her. And he very quickly apologized and realized he shouldn't have done. But she then took out a grievance against him for bullying, because he had shouted at her in front of other people and humiliated her. Now, of course, she had the right to do that. But can you see how that extra tension, that extra level of stress pushed him over the edge, and that was when he took his own life as a result of that. Now, of course, most instances of bullying are not that extreme, but I regularly encounter on my travels people talking to me about situations where I'm having to say to them, what you're describing is bullying. Yeah? And again, that is relatively new. When I say relatively new, I don't mean in the last year or two, but certainly in the last decade or two for that to creep in. And then last but not least, in terms of this point at least, is the significance of anxiety. I think we have a major problem with anxiety in modern social work, because what I see on a regular basis is situations where people in the community, whether they are clients, carers, other professionals, get anxious about a situation. They come to a social worker and make that social worker anxious. You then have managers who are managing whole teams of anxious people, and the managers get anxious. And before you know it, you've got organizations that are just like seething masses of anxiety. Now, I've mentioned this on various training courses I've run, and people have said to me, have you been to our office? So I'm well aware that this is a significant issue. Now, as I see it, it comes back to something that Carl Rogers said about 50 years ago. He said, one anxious person in the room is enough. Yeah? In other words, anxiety is contagious. And I think one of the things we need to be able to do as professionals, and I think this is part of leadership as well, one of the things we need to do is that if somebody comes to us in an anxious state, is that we help to make them less anxious, not allow them to make us anxious. But you see how it can get into a vicious circle. If everybody around you is anxious, it's really difficult not to be anxious. So it becomes really challenging. And a lot of that anxiety comes from, well, it comes from different sources, but one of those sources is what we're talking about here, this managerialism lowering morale, and increasing bureaucracy, and so on. So again, one of the consequences is conflict, bullying, and anxiety. But then what's also significant is we can have less learning and less creativity. Because of what I've just been talking about, all those different things, all those other consequences can mean that there's a tendency for people to just get on with the job, to just focus on surviving. How do I get through the day? And that sort of thing. Now, if you see how if that's happening, then there's very little learning going on. And what I'm finding as well, and this links in with the issue around anxiety again, what I'm finding as well is that so many people now are frightened of creativity. For example, I regularly run courses on reflective practice. And as part of those courses, I say, for me, a key part of reflective practice is to be able to think laterally. Not just to think in terms of I do this, then I do that, and then I do whatever comes next, but to think more creatively about what are the possible solutions to this situation. And I give examples of creative thinking, partly from my own experience as a former practitioner, and partly from experiences other people have told me about on courses and so on. And it's interesting that I regularly get people saying things like, I like that idea of being more creative, but I'm not sure I could do that where I work because it would be too risky. There's too much anxiety to try something new. What if it goes wrong? That sort of thing. And again, that's something that's changed during the course of my career. It's not something that's inherent in the nature of social work. It's something that's inherent in the current climate, if you like. The current culture of thinking. Now, I'm based in Wales, and in Wales there's going to be some interesting developments next April, because that's when a new act gets implemented. That act is called the Social Services and Wellbeing Act, and one of the emphases of that act is the need for practitioners to be more creative and to be more community focused. So instead of what I call consumerism, which is the emphasis on what services can we give people, part of the new act in Wales is that people will only be able to be considered for a service once all the other possibilities for dealing with their problems, their unmet needs and so on, have been explored and exhausted. There is a phrase that's been coined in Welsh social policy now, which is the can and can only clause. Not cannelloni, it's nothing to do with pasta. It's the can and can only. And what that means is that for somebody to receive a service, then they can have that service. In other words, it's got to be available. You can't give a service that's not available. But it's got to be only that service that can solve the problem. So if there are other means of addressing people's needs, solving their problems, empowering them and so on, then before you can offer somebody a service. Now contrast that with the experience I've had in recent years of running courses on outcome-focused practice, where many people on those courses have said to me things like, you know what, Neil, I hadn't thought about it before, but this course has made me realize that I find myself driving to people's houses thinking, what service can I give these people? Yeah. Now, do you see how that's putting the cart before the horse in terms of thinking about what service do we give people? As I say, I call that consumerism. Do you see how that's got its roots in neoliberalism? It's about the market. It's about goods, distribution of goods and services, not about professional issues like empowerment and helping people grow in terms of being able to address their own needs and problems where possible. So this situation then is a further reflection of neoliberalism in that sense. So what's going to be happening in Wales from next April is there's going to have to be a much greater emphasis on creativity, on thinking laterally about how do we move forward, rather than getting into a sort of a bureaucratic consumerist rut of does this person meet the eligibility criteria for receiving a service. So moving away from, as I say, the that consumerist neoliberal approach. So it's going to be very interesting in Wales next year. Okay, now one last thing in terms of the consequences, what I call self-defeating cultures. And what I mean by self-defeating cultures are cultures that are characterized by negativity and defeatism and even cynicism. I've had so many conversations with so many different people in so many different parts of the country around these issues. A common experience is somebody joins a team as a social worker or whatever, and they're bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. They're keen to do a job. They want to be positive. They know it's going to be hard. They know it's going to be challenging, but they want to do a good job. And within a month, they're sitting around moaning with everybody else. The culture got them. And I've actually been training social work students in various places how not to be culture victims. Yeah? About what to do if you end up working in a culture where it's all about moaning and groaning and negativity and, as I say, a self-defeating culture. Now, there's two ironies to this. One is that as professional problem solvers, shouldn't we be looking at solving our own problems rather than sitting around moaning about those problems? Yeah. Consider, for example, how people often tell me that they've got too much work to do. And then I will say words to the effect of, okay, fair enough, I can appreciate that. I'm not denying it. But I will then say, am I right in thinking that somebody with high morale can achieve twice as much in a day compared with somebody who's got rock-bottom morale? And people normally readily agree with that and say, yeah, they don't see any problem with somebody with high morale achieving twice as much as somebody with low morale. If you do the maths, what that tells you is low morale doubles the workload, because you could get twice as much done if you didn't have the low morale. So, and this is part of a professional challenge, and then to my mind, part of a leadership challenge, is what we need to be doing then is pulling together and helping each other to deal with difficult circumstances and do the best we can in difficult circumstances, rather than make those difficult circumstances worse by creating and sustaining a culture of sitting around moaning and not doing anything about your problems. So that's one irony, is that as professional problem solvers, shouldn't we be looking at our own problems and trying to do something as best we can? But linked to that is the second irony. And what I mean by the second irony is, isn't this often the situation that we encounter in the community? Are we not often working with individuals and families who, in a sense, have written themselves off? They tell us about their problems, and we say, have you tried this? Yeah, it didn't work. Have you tried? No, that didn't work either. And so on. Do you see how they have got this culture, this self-defeating culture, either within a family, or you can have just individuals living on their own. It can be the same sort of mindset, if you like, of writing themselves off, disempowering themselves. Now, this is not a criticism of individuals. This is a reflection of what happens when people are put in situations like the one I've described, where there is negative messages coming through the very system. The message from the system is, we don't trust you to be professionals. We will check up on you. It's no coincidence, for example, that Eileen Munro, in a review of child protection, talked about the need for reflective supervision, because she was well aware, as I am, that a lot of supervision is what I call snoopervision. Yeah? Have you done this? Have you done that? Are your records up to date? What about your reviews? And what Eileen Munro was basically saying was, we need to be saying, it's okay, there's no need to check up on me. I'm a professional. Now let me convince you that you can trust me. So back to the professionalism, back to the leadership issue. But am I right in thinking we have a problem with self-defeating cultures? Yeah, that's something. That's a leadership issue, as we'll come on to shortly. So, why focus on leadership? That then brings us to, well, what is leadership? Perhaps we need to just take a step back and think, okay, there are some really important issues to do with leadership, as I've been outlining, but what exactly do we mean by leadership? Now, I could stand here until about 6 o'clock tonight, going through different conceptions of leadership, different models, different definitions, and so on, but you wouldn't thank me for it. It's tedious stuff. So I'm going to focus on just a couple of issues that are significant. One thing that I think is very important is what the textbooks call path-goal theory. So the idea behind this is a leader is someone who is able to identify the goals. In other words, what you're trying to achieve. If it is, say, a team manager, then that team manager needs to be clear, what do we need to achieve to be a successful, well-functioning team? That's the goal, to be a successful, well-functioning team, whatever that may mean in the particular circumstances. But that's the general principle. And then a leader, according to this approach, is somebody who identifies the path to achieve that goal. So in order to be a successful, effective team, we need open communication. For example, we don't want people going off into corners and moaning about things and just feeding low morale. What we want is people coming to team meetings, for example, and saying, we've got a problem with X. How are we going to deal with it, gang? Yeah, that sort of thing. So that's the idea of path-goal theory, is having clarity about whatever the domain of leadership is you are responsible for, whether it's a team manager for a team, whether it's a chief executive officer for a whole organization, or whether it's a social worker for their caseload. The domain of leadership that you are responsible for, a key part of that is being clear about where do we need to get to and how are we going to get there. And then from the management point of view, that management aspect of leadership is about how do you take people with you. Rather than just saying, you, and you, we're going here, let's get moving. But to actually get people on board, as it were, to get that sense of shared endeavour, as I like to call it. So that's where things like teamwork come in. So this is one significant aspect of leadership, is the idea of path-goal theory. Now, what I think is just as important, if not more so, and I want to focus on this quite a lot because I think this is crucial, is the idea of culture shaping. And what I mean by culture shaping is, well, let's start off, what do I mean by culture? A culture is basically a set of habits. It's a set of unwritten rules. It's a set of assumptions about the way we do things around here. Put a group of people together and a culture will very quickly form. It's interesting how in our Western ways of thinking, we tend to predominantly think about individuals and pay relatively little attention to what happens when you bring individuals together. Because let's face it, most of our time is spent with other people. It's not spent in isolation, as some psychology textbooks would have you believe, focusing just on what's happening between your ears, as it were. It's so much of it is about what's happening between people. I mean, even on a two-day training course, for example, I can see cultures developing. I can see who sits where. I can see who asks questions and who doesn't. And, you know, so if I throw out a question to the group, I can see certain people look to the person they expect to answer the question and stuff like that. Now, do you see how that's a culture that has developed? I was once asked to spend a day teaching with a group of social work students on a degree program. And I was warned as we were walking down the corridor to the classroom, I was warned that they are a silent group. You'll be hard pressed to get anything out of them. Don't take it personally. They're like that with everybody. It's just one of those things. But don't expect a lot of discussion. So I thought, right, I'm not spending a full day talking and nobody responding. I'm not having that. So what I did was I said, okay, everybody, I want you to all stand up. And I want those people who were born in January to stand at that side of the room. Those people born in December to stand at that far corner of the room. And work out where you fit. So if you're born in June, work out where you fit in the line. But you've got to do it without saying a word. And so a couple of minutes later, they're all sort of gesticulating to each other and so on. They find their place in this line from January to December across the room. And then I went, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you lot sit around that table. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you sit around that table. And I dispersed them. And then we started the session. I couldn't shut them up. Why do you think that was? That's right. Do you see how I had shaped the culture? Their culture was, we sit here with our mates, we write down everything the tutor says, and when the tutor says any comments or questions, nobody speaks. So when they were sitting in their favourite spot with their favourite people next to them and so on, do you see how they felt quite secure in maintaining that culture of nobody says anything? When that culture was gone because they weren't sitting in their favourite seat, they weren't sitting with the people they knew, they were more open to actually responding to what I was doing. So do you see how that's an example of culture shaping? Now, cultures can take years to develop in some circumstances, and sometimes it takes years to change them. But sometimes they can be changed overnight. For example, if you've got a culture where people don't communicate, then it's relatively straightforward for a leader, get people communicating. And you see how that culture will very quickly disappear. Because at the end of the day, cultures are not entities with a mind of their own. They don't make decisions. They don't do things. They're just sets of habits, in a sense. It's just the dead weight of habit. So it's in the right circumstances, not always, but in the right circumstances, cultures can be changed by breaking those habits. So what does that involve then? Well, an important part of that is you need to know your culture. So whether you're a manager or you're a practitioner sharing the leadership responsibility in a team or a group of staff, you need to know your culture, because the way culture works is it's like a drip, drip, drip effect. So you pick it up as you go along. And one of the reasons cultures are so powerful is that generally you don't notice they're there. They've become part of you, in a sense. They've become part of your habit, that you just respond to situations in a predefined way. If you want the technical term, it's a neural pathway. Yeah, so what's happened is, in a sense, you've trained your brain and your nervous system to respond in a sort of a semi-automatic way to a situation. And that's what makes it so powerful, is a lot of the time you don't even realize you're doing it. So step one in terms of culture shaping is you've got to know what the culture is. You've got to know what are the unwritten rules. What's different about this group of people compared with the group of people in the next room, or the group of people you worked with 2 years ago, or whatever, to identify what are these unwritten rules, these taken for granted assumptions. So do you see how by making the implicit explicit, you take its power away? If you know what it's doing, you can guard against it. If you know that there is a tendency for people not to communicate, then you can make a concerted effort to communicate, and that habit will very quickly die out. So that's the first thing, is to know your culture, and then from that, identify the benefits and the problems. And this will apply to any culture. whether it's a dreadful culture or a wonderful culture, it won't be all bad or all good. There will always be a mixture of strong points, benefits, if you like, and problems, issues that are not as good as they could be. Let's face it, there's no such thing as a perfect culture. So once you're clear about what does this culture consist of, what are the key issues in terms of the unwritten rules, the taken for granted assumptions, and so on, and then subdivide them into, well, actually, this habit, this unwritten rule, is actually quite good. For example, I used to work in a team where we had a team secretary who had emotional radar. And what I mean by that, the slightest hint of distress by any member of the team, you know, because they just come back from a difficult interview, for example, the slightest hint, and she'd head straight for the kettle. Yeah? Now, do you see how that was an important part of the culture? That was a positive thing. I'm sure nobody would want to say, oh, look, we've got to stop doing this. But there were other things about that culture that were not so good that it was important to work on to try and get away from. So can you see what I'm getting at here? Be clear about what is the culture, what are the unwritten rules. You can think about it yourself, you can do it as a team exercise. Do it at a team meeting. What are the unwritten rules of our team? And then focus on how can we build on the strengths, reinforce them, and how can we minimize the negatives. So that's what it boils down to. Reinforce the benefits, minimize the problems. Step one, what are the cultural assumptions? Step two, divide them into positives and negatives. Step three, reinforce the positives. Try and undermine or preferably remove the negatives where possible. Sometimes it won't be possible, of course, but we don't want to decide that in advance and write ourselves off. So that's a key part of this idea of culture shaping. Now, one other point I want to make about culture shaping is the importance of shaping the culture, not fighting it. A lot of people make this mistake. They try to fight a culture, and what we have to recognize is cultures are much more powerful than any individual. If it comes to a battle between you and the culture is going to win. An individual cannot beat a culture. That's why the emphasis is on shaping the culture. Cultures can't fight back because they're not conscious entities. Like I say, they're just sets of habits, unwritten rules, taken for granted assumptions. But those habits are powerful, they're strong. So if you've got, for example, let's say a team manager who's thinking, the problem with my team is that they're too negative. And so what they decide to do is make the team more positive. So they try and fight that negative culture. So they keep saying at every opportunity to the team, come on, let's be positive. Let's not whinge. Let's be positive. Come on, team, let's be positive. Now, of course, what's going to happen is while that person is in the room, everyone's going to nod and smile. And as soon as... You lot are psychic. You know what I'm going to say before I say it. And so what will happen then is, of course, as soon as that person leaves the room, they all look at each other and say, pillock. Am I right? Do you see... Humour aside, do you see the serious point in this? It's no good fighting a culture. It's the culture will win. What you have to do is change the culture, shape the culture. If you've got a negative culture, for example, then it's no good just saying, cheer up, everybody. You know, those of you got a mental health background will know that's the equivalent to going to somebody who's depressed and tell them to cheer up. Can you see how it ain't going to work? Basically, you've got to look at it more holistically, if you like, in terms of where is all this negativity coming from? And what can we do to change the unwritten rules, the taken for granted assumptions, and so on? So that's what can be done to shape a culture. And as I've said, cultures can develop very quickly, and they can be changed very quickly in a lot of cases. And I want to emphasize, not always, because sometimes some people have a vested interest in the culture. It suits them to have the culture in that way. So while the culture can't fight back, some individuals can. So it can create problems. So I don't want to paint too rosy a picture of, oh, you just changed the assumption. That can lead to tensions. But I don't want to go to the other extreme either. And to agree with what a lot of people have said to me over the years, you can't change a culture. You know, cultures are like rock solid. They've taken years to develop. You can't change a culture. And I have to say, I'm very sorry, but I've done it umpteen times. I've seen other people do it many, many times. I don't want to then overgeneralize and say you can always change a culture, but what I'm saying is in a significant number of cases, you can change a culture, you can shape it. And in some circumstances, it's relatively easy. It's relatively straightforward to do that. Going back to the issue about anxiety, for example, one of the nicest compliments I've ever had was when I became a team manager. I took over on a Monday a new team. I'd met most of the people in the team, but I hadn't really worked with them before. So I started on Monday. On Thursday of that week, I had my first supervision session with my my boss. And he started the supervision session by saying, "Neil, I knew it was the right decision to appoint you, and you've proved me right. Because I've been chatting to team members this morning, and they think you're great. They think you're doing a fantastic job." And I was really puzzled by this because I was thinking, I only arrived on Monday, it's Thursday. I'd spent most of my time wandering around the hospital trying to find my way back to the to my office. You know, being in this embarrassing situation of having to say to people, "Excuse me, can you direct me to the social work department?" And hoping they didn't know I was the head of the social work department. But it was one of those old Victorian hospitals, you know, that like a rabbit warren. But anyway, so do you see, it came as a big surprise to me that the team was saying such positive things within a few days. So I said to my boss, "I'm puzzled. Well, thanks for the compliment, first of all." And then I said, "But I'm really puzzled by it because, you know, how do they know that I'm so great when they've hardly got to know me?" And what he said was, "You've changed the culture in the team already." And I hadn't done it deliberately. It had happened by accident. And that taught me a lot, because I thought, if I can change a culture by accident, what can I do if I'm trying? And what it was this anxiety issue. Because I'd met my predecessor a couple of times, but I didn't really know her. But what quickly emerged was that she was somebody who fostered anxiety. Yeah, so if a member of the team went to her with a problem, she would say things, "Oh my God, what are we going to do about this? Oh dear, oh my," and wind them up, basically. So what would happen is she would press this button, basically, that increased the tension and anxiety in that individual. And you can see, because she was doing that consistently with every member of the team, before you knew it, what you had was a team that was being eaten away by anxiety. That was on the Friday. On the Monday, I came in and confidently, calmly, "Morning all, how we doing? It's great to be with you. Really glad that we're going to be working together," and all this sort of thing. And I basically don't do anxiety. And that's what came through. Is, do you see how the stark contrast between this person who was fueling anxiety and me coming along saying, "Anxiety, what's that?" It was, you know, and I remember saying to people, partly joking and partly seriously, I remember saying when they'd come to me in a bit of a flap, I would say things like, "Well, what should we do? Should we panic now, or should we have a cup of tea and talk things over and then panic?" And, you know, they took that in the spirit it was intended and could see, yeah, there's no point panicking, let's talk about it calmly. So do you see how within a matter of a few days that anxiety had dispersed and people felt much more confident with somebody who doesn't wind them up, who does what I said before? You know, I think as professionals, if somebody comes to us who's anxious, it's our job to make them less anxious, not let them make us more anxious. And I think that's an important set of skills, is being able to manage other people's anxiety so that you don't have a problem managing your own anxiety then. So that's part of this idea of shaping the culture, don't fight it. And as I say, this is a very common mistake. I've seen so many people over the years who have tried to fight a culture and have basically lost the battle. Now, if you say once they've lost the battle, they've lost credibility. And I think that's an important part of leadership, whether as a practitioner, stroke professional, leader, or as a management type leader, credibility is important. People are not going to be influenced by you if you've got no credibility. And that's part of this picture that I'm trying to shape here. Okay, so to my mind, this is what leadership is all about. There's an element of the path goal theory, be clear where you're trying to get to and how you're going to get there. But then a major part of it is this idea of shaping and sustaining, because one of the dangers with culture is that they quickly revert to the old ways of doing. Old habits die hard, as they say. Creating, shaping and sustaining a positive culture that will boost morale, will therefore help people get through the work, turn a vicious circle into a virtuous circle, and so on. Key elements of leadership there. So what's particularly significant about authentic leadership? Now, I said earlier in my sort of general introduction that I've not really been happy with the stuff that's been written about authentic leadership. I think they've got it wrong. Most of the stuff that's been written about leadership in terms of authentic leadership is about being true to yourself, of like discovering your real you underneath and being true to that. Now, as far as I'm concerned, that is a gross oversimplification of our understanding of selfhood and identity. The idea that we have a real self underneath is, to use the technical term, essentialist. And being essentialist, believe me, is not a good thing. It means that you are a fixed entity. You are who you are, and that's it. Now, it doesn't take much thinking to work out that if that was the case, people couldn't change. But I don't know about you, I see people changing all the time. So a much better idea of selfhood, of identity, is the notion of a fluid self. The existentialist idea that you are a process of becoming, in a sense, and that you're not complete until basically the day you die. That everything you've built up in terms of your identity and your sense of self could change. You could take a totally different direction because of circumstances, because of choices you make, and so on. I'm in the process at the moment of co-editing a book on traumatic loss with a couple of American colleagues. They put me under great pressure to be part of their team. And one of the significant things about trauma is the idea that you may or may not have come across, it's what's known as biographical disruption. And what biographical disruption means is traumatic events can mean that you don't know who you are anymore. That the things you've taken for granted, the things that have been, in a sense, part of the foundations of your life, can be taken away. So that you just have this sense of, I don't know who I am anymore. Now, do you see how that doesn't fit with the idea of you are who you are, that you have this real, genuine you underneath the surface, and that to be a good leader, you have to get in touch with yourself in some way. So it isn't about being true to yourself. What it's about, and this is where the existentialist philosophy comes in, it's about taking ownership of your actions and encouraging others to take ownership of their actions. It's basically about recognizing that there are always choices, but choices always have consequences. And what can easily happen, this is what existentialists call bad faith. What can easily happen is people deny ownership of their actions. They say, I can't help it, it's the way I am. I was born like that. Or it's the way I was brought up. Things like that. And it saddens me, for example, that the advances that have been made in neuropsychology in recent years are now reinforcing that idea of, I can't help it, it's the way my neuropsychology works. You know, that's the way I'm hardwired to do whatever it is I do, and this sort of thing, which of course is something that neuropsychologists wouldn't accept for a moment. A key part of neuropsychology is the idea of the plasticity, the malleability, if you like, of the brain and nervous system. But you see how that's been popularized and oversimplified into this idea of we're hardwired to do certain things. And it totally oversimplifies a very complex set of issues. And it's often used as a way of denying ownership, denying responsibility for our actions. And can you see how this can happen in a culture? The same issues. Well, I'd like to be more motivated, but I can't because morale's so low where I work. Can you see how that works? It's denying responsibility for your actions, the choices. So what it's about is recognizing, as I say, there are always choices, but there are always consequences to those choices. And sometimes, because people don't want to face up to the consequences, then they deny the choices. They try and paint a picture of a situation where they have a choice, but they like to pretend they haven't, or to fool themselves that they haven't, because they feel more comfortable, they feel safer with that. Now, if we go back to all the tensions in the workplace that I was describing and trying to explain before, can you see how those tensions make that bad faith more likely? Yeah. If you're in a really difficult, demanding situation, thinking the decision I make, the choice I take, could have significant consequences, then trying to find a way of saying it's not down to me, blame them, blame the culture, blame my neuroplasticity or whatever, then that's those types of thinking are more likely to occur in a situation of tension and anxiety. Now, an important word here is anguish, because you see, anxiety is a general term, and it can refer to feeling anxious about things you've got no control over. You can feel anxious about, for example, driving, not because you necessarily doubt your own ability to drive, but you don't trust those other buggers. Yeah? So the anxiety can come from things you've got no control over. But anxiety can also come from the things you do have control over. What if I take this step and it turns out to be the wrong one? What if I think the degree of risk in this situation is acceptable and then it turns out that it goes pear-shaped? Or if I think it's not acceptable and I take actions that are actually worse than if I'd left things alone? Now, that's where the term anguish comes in, because that's a specific type of anxiety. It's anxiety about what you've got control over. What if I do this wrong? What if I make a mistake? What if I foul up, basically? Now, do you see how trying to run away from that anguish just makes it worse? It just digs you into a deeper hole. It becomes a vicious circle. And am I right in thinking that, again, going back to what I said about what happens to individuals and families that we're trying to help, is this something that we encounter quite a lot? Yeah. For example, in terms of child abuse, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the people who don't take ownership, the perpetrators I mean now, that the perpetrators who don't take ownership of their actions are the ones who are more likely to reoffend. Yeah. You know, if somebody is saying, it wasn't my fault, she seduced me, and all that sort of thing. She said, how they don't take ownership, then the theory and the research would both support the view that if that person's not taking ownership of their actions, she said, they're more likely to reoffend then. Because next time they're in a situation where they're, for example, sexually attracted to a child, then they're going to be looking for reasons outside of themselves for why it's acceptable to get sexually involved with a child, rather than to take ownership and actually say, no, it's understandable that I'm attracted to that child, but I am not going to act on it because that's abusive. So do you see how there's an issue there about ownership? But what I want to emphasize, though, is that ownership and blame are two different things. I don't want anybody going away thinking, oh, he's just adding to the blame culture in a sense. But ironically, what will happen is if we don't take ownership of our actions, if we do put it down to factors beyond our control when we could have done something about it, then we actually feed the blame culture because more things will go wrong, and that will give those people, like the media, for example, or sectors of the media, that will give those people the ammunition they need to fire against us. Does that make sense? Yeah, see where I'm coming from? So this is a key part of the idea of authentic leadership. As the book says, let's not be seduced by this idea that it's about leaders digging deep and finding their real self. What it's about is leaders have to take ownership of their actions, and they have to create cultures where other people take ownership of their actions. In other words, we're all grown-ups together, and we actually support each other in making difficult decisions. How we communicate with one another about issues and not try and sort of push the blame onto somebody else or to say, oh, it's nothing I could do. Now, just to finish off on this before we sort of throw it open for a bit of discussion, the technical terms here are facticity and transcendence. And what this refers to is facticity is a technical term that means that refers to situations you can do nothing about. It's a fact. Yeah, that's the idea. Facticity is those things you can do nothing about. If you are cut, you will bleed. You see how you don't choose to bleed. It's not a matter of choice. There are certain things you have no control over. But then there are things you do have control over. And that's the idea of transcendence, because to transcend means to go beyond. And what it means is any situation you find yourself in, you transcend it, you go beyond it. And you do that by making choices. So that brings us then to the idea that there are always choices, but choices always have consequences. Can you see how that works? For example, Jean-Paul Sartre, who's probably the best-known existentialist writer, he gave an example of this about a prisoner in a cell. Now, you might think that a prisoner in a cell has got no choices, no freedom, totally constrained within that cell. So when it comes to things like choices and transcendence and stuff like that, it's not going to happen to a prisoner in their cell. Or is it? Because what Sartre said is, imagine a situation where one of the prison officers brings a tray of food, gives that to the prisoner. Can you see how that prisoner now has several choices? They can eat the food, they can play with it, they can throw it away, they can do all sorts of things. So do you see how even in those most constrained of circumstances, being in a prison cell, there are still choices that not only you can make, but you have to make. Because one key principle of existentialist thought is that not making a choice is a choice. It's what's sometimes called the paradox of choice. Can you see how that works? Let's say you see a job advertised and you can't decide whether to apply for it or not. Oh, it might be better than what I've got now, but it might be worse. I don't know, shall I apply for it? And you know that the closing date is, I don't know, the 8th of December. if by the 8th of December you're still not sure whether to apply or not, and then by the 9th of December you're still not sure whether to apply or not, you've decided not to apply. Can you see how, if you know that that's when the closing date is, then not applying was a choice. By continuing to entertain the uncertainty, then the choice was you didn't apply. Yeah? Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm coming from? Now, that's actually much more common than people generally think. It's not just, you know, in like the odd occasion when you apply for a job, or all sorts of things that in a way happen by default. They happen because we don't do anything to stop them happening. And in that way, we are making a choice. And so this comes back to the idea of transcendence, because transcendence means whatever the situation is, you have to react to it. You have to accept it or challenge it. You have to react to it, because what's the alternative? To be in a coma? And so this is the idea of what's sometimes called the existential journey, is that who you are is not a fixed entity going through life, but who you are is that journey. And it's about the choices you make, the steps you take. So it's this constant process of becoming. Now, do you see, in terms of leadership, whether it's management type leadership or professional leadership in terms of social workers working directly with people, then it's about taking ownership of your own actions, the choices you make, being aware of what they are and what decisions you're making and why, but helping other people make those decisions as well. You know, to help them wrestle with their existential choices, if you like, their challenge of transcendence. Okay, now just very quickly to sum up, then we'll have time for some questions before we do the sort of formal book launch bit. Just to sum up, what I've been trying to say today is that at root, the situation we're in today is about the wider political picture of this ideology of neoliberalism. The idea that if you let the market forces run their course, everything will work out for the best. And that's a very dubious assumption, but it's the dominant thinking at the moment in so many different ways. As a result of that, we've had for so many years now this managerialism about trying to squeeze a public service model so that it looks more like a business model, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, as I said before. That creates all sorts of problems, tensions, undermines a sense of professionalism and so on. Now, to respond to all of that is quite a challenge of leadership in the managerial leadership sense and in the professional leadership sense. It presents us with a significant set of challenges, and that's why leadership is so important. And to my mind, leadership is partly about being clear where you're trying to get to and how you're going to get there, but especially about shaping a culture that will create the opportunity to get to where you need to get to. And to make that an authentic leadership, then we've got to recognise that it's about seeing the choices we make individually and collectively and taking ownership of those. Okay, so I hope that was helpful. Thank you.